Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, it's that time of year when we remember that the real first Thanksgiving happened in Florida 55 years before the Pilgrims landed.
When people think of Thanksgiving as like a turkey or a ham or something, you know, that's really not what natives would have brought to the table at all. So in Northeast Florida, you know, probably would have been venison, probably would have been fish, probably would have been something from the coastline.
We'll discuss the age of glamorous nightclubs in Miami Beach.
Like all dazzling moments, it faded too quickly, undermined by its own gold rush mentality and the appearance of a new competitor against which nightclubs had few options.
And we'll talk about Zora Neale Hurston in Fort Pierce. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
So fill your plate and fill your drink and fill this house with family, the kind of love that all these years can't wash away. 'Cause the older that I get, I see the life is short and bittersweet. Thank God for this Thanksgiving Day.
Tradition holds that the first Thanksgiving was celebrated in 1621 as English pilgrims at Plymouth Plantation in Massachusetts shared a bountiful harvest with their Native American neighbors. The first Thanksgiving in North America actually took place in Florida. 55 years before the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, Spanish colonists in St. Augustine shared a feast of Thanksgiving with Native Americans. The traditional story of the first Thanksgiving in 1621 is based upon limited information from pilgrims Edward Winslow and William Bradford. Kevin Cocamore is author of the award-winning book La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories.
That's what I think was most surprising to me when I first started looking into the Pilgrim Plymouth version, is that the sources are still more than the sources that you get from the St. Augustine. The sources that you get from St. Augustine is not even an entire sentence. It doesn't get a whole lot less than that. But the surprising part was that I think from Bradford and Winslow's accounts of Plymouth, you know, collectively, their experiences were no more than a few sentences. So yeah, we are talking about, in both cases, traditions that, you know, we can make a lot of really educated guesses about what happened, but the sources are pretty scarce for both of them.
Florida historian Michael Gannon identified September 8, 1565 as the date of the real first Thanksgiving in his 1965 book, The Cross in the Sand. That was the day that Don Pedro Menendez de Avilés and his crew first landed in St. Augustine. Kevin Cocamore points out that Menendez hosted other Thanksgiving feasts on Our Lady's Day, St. Matthew's Day, and All Saints' Day.
I agreed with him in that there were several, because there were several really important sort of sub-stories to the founding of St. Augustine. There was thanks that had to be given for literally making it alive across the Atlantic. There was thanks for establishing St. Augustine. And then there were the thanks that were given for the several massacres. And so there was only one in which I think Grijalva basically says, who is the friar that's there with him, who is the Catholic priest that's there with him, that there's one in particular, and that's the September one, where he basically says, Menendez de Avilés gives thanks and feeds the natives. And so there are several moments when the Spaniards stop to give thanks, but there's really only one source that says he had dinner and he dined with the natives, right? So Yeah, that's why he went with that a date, and that seems pretty accurate. And again, I mean, that's really all we have is that one sentence.
Kevin Kokamore begins his book, La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories, by building upon Michael Gannon's challenging of the first Thanksgiving narrative. From there, Kokamore demonstrates that Spanish, non-English, and non-Protestant people had a much greater impact on the development of America than what they have been previously given credit for.
The idea of La Florida is not just that it is the peninsula that we now know as the state of Florida, right? And in the earliest years of La Florida, it was Spain's claim to most of North America. And so I try to be very careful in the introduction to sort of describe all of this as this is not a triumphant tale of Catholicism. This is not basically, you know, neo-colonialist, you know, the Spanish basically made North America what it is. I wasn't trying to bring that interpretation to it at all. But the Spanish, their attempt at colonization, their unsuccessful attempts at colonization, and then their successful endeavors, beginning with St. Augustine, it impacted early American history in a lot of really important ways. The colonization leads to the missions in the Southeast, it leads to the disease, and it leads to the exploitation of Native peoples, which really ushers in the transformation of the Southeast, is an example. The foodways tradition, which I try to think of as kind of a little bit lighter than the quote unquote transformation of the Native South. The foodways traditions, I think, are also surprisingly Spanish. Oranges in Florida, cattle in the Southeast, pigs in the Southeast. I even argue about barbecue in the Southeast. All has, in one way or another, been influenced by the Spanish attempts to colonize the Southeast. So the Catholic part of that is a very important part of that story. It is the reason why Spaniards were in the Caribbean. It is an important reason why they established St. Augustine and the missions that followed. And so when I talk about the first Thanksgiving, it really shows this deep Catholic connection to the settling of, or the attempt to settle, Florida. And it is one of the most important driving factors in the early colonization. And that's something that would surprise most people because, again, and this is the larger idea of the book, is that when most people think of early American history and when most people think of the early religious history of the country, they think Protestant, not Catholic. And so the first Thanksgiving I use as an introduction because it sort of busts that myth a little bit.
The 1619 Project identifies that year as the starting point for American slavery and re-examines the long-term effects of slavery. Kokamore points out that Spanish slaves had been in Florida throughout the previous century.
The Thanksgiving tradition is the way I started it out, and 1619 is the way I actually wrapped up the book, because one of the most important legacies in early American history is that date in which enslaved people were sold in the English colonies. And if you wanted to complicate that, that is absolutely objectively true when it came to the English colonies. But Florida had already been in existence for generations, and slavery in Florida had already been in existence for generations. And in a lot of ways, it was unique. The Spanish crown owned people in a way that the English government didn't. The Catholic Church treated enslaved people differently than, say, the churches, the Anglican Church in Virginia or in South Carolina. So there are differences, but there's also a lot of really important similarities. Slavery in Florida was chattel slavery. It treated people as property that existed in Florida. And it wasn't just a native slavery. It was the Atlantic slave trade. And so it was the same Atlantic slave trade that would remake and that would influence the development of the American Southeast. It really has a legacy in Florida that predates 1619 by, I mean, in some cases, you could argue an entire century. And so not only do I suggest that slavery in Florida predates Virginia and 1619, it actually predates Virginia, right? So you have the enslaved history of North America is actually, I guess you could say technically, earlier than the English history of North America. And that's a pretty stunning addition to early American history.
Kevin Cocamore earned the Charlton Tabou Book Award for his important documentation of Spanish influences on early American development, a topic largely ignored until now.
Everything has flowed from the Pilgrims and from New England. It's just such an American story. It's Protestant. It is sort of the homogenous sort of idea of what makes Americans, is this triumphant story of Pilgrims. I mean, the Pilgrim story in a lot of ways is even more popular than the Jamestown story. I mean, when people think of the early English settlements that make the United States of America, a lot of people, you know, without thinking twice, would point to Plymouth and point to Pilgrim heritage as sort of like the first real American heritage. And that's just been ingrained in our popular culture. It's just been ingrained in our popular history. And, you know, it's not that that's not important, but that is only a part of the story of a very complicated North America. And so when you think of American history, you just don't think of a Catholic history. You don't think of a Spanish history. That's not what you've been taught in grade school. That's not what you've been taught basically in popular culture and in movies. It just sort of flowed with this. It is the dominant narrative of the country. And again, it's not that it's entirely wrong, but it is oversimplifying things to a great deal.
We can't talk about Thanksgiving without discussing the menu. It's questionable whether or not the modern Thanksgiving meal of turkey, stuffing, and cranberry sauce is based on historical fact. Kevin Cocamore speculates about what would have been served at the real first Thanksgiving in St. Augustine.
So you got to think of what Spaniards would have had on hand and what the natives would have had on hand. So, you know, wild fowl probably would have been there. We think if it's the Southeast, and this is probably the same with the Northeast, actually. When people think of Thanksgiving as like a turkey or a ham or something, you know, that's really not what natives would have brought to the table at all. So in Northeast Florida, you know, probably would have been venison, probably would have been fish, probably would have been something from the coastline. That's what they would have offered if they had brought anything at all. And what the Spaniards would have offered would have been, you know, this really sort of classic Spanish bean soup, I would imagine. A lot of cured, heavily salted ham, garbanzo beans. It would have been brothy, probably extremely salty. Probably would have washed it down with quite a bit of wine. You know, the Spaniards would have had that on board as well. And something sweet, I think some people have suggested maybe honey, maybe biscuits, something made with flour. So it definitely would not have looked like the Thanksgiving that we have now. Absolutely not. It would have been pretty unimpressive, actually.
I think I'll stick with turkey this year. Kevin Cocamore is author of the book La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories. We discussed the real first Thanksgiving held in 1565 in St. Augustine, 56 years before the Pilgrim celebration. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture. Watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
At the Copacabana, the hottest spot north of Havana.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, following World War II, people were in a mood to celebrate, and Miami Beach was ready to accommodate them with an active nightclub scene.
Yes, they were. Not everyone who is published in the Florida Historical Quarterly is an academic historian. One of the more interesting articles was submitted by an associate professor in public administration at Florida International University, Keith D. Revel. His article, The Rise and Fall of Copa City, 1944 to 1957, appeared in the spring 2017 issue of the Quarterly. It explores the life of the city's most glamorous era of nightclubs and high-end entertainment. Copa City, Revel tells us, was the product of a dazzling moment in the history of Miami Beach as a world-class tourist destination. Like all dazzling moments, it faded too quickly, undermined by its own gold rush mentality and the appearance of a new competitor against which nightclubs had few options. Revel uses Copa City to illuminate the role of nightlife in the rapid evolution of Miami Beach as a tourist city. The Nightery, as nightclubs were called in the trade, lured nationally and internationally known entertainers to perform on its stage before succumbing to unmanageable debt and the next form of competition. Copa City was a glamorous and important moment in the tourism history of Miami Beach.
And even in the mid-20th century, Miami Beach nightclubs were ready to serve diverse audiences.
They were. In his 1981 book on New York nightlife, Louis A. Ehrenberg argued that that city's nightclubs facilitated the transition from the staid mores of Victorian gentility by creating new styles of consumption, sexual expression, and social interaction. Nightclubs, he says, transformed the deviant, disreputable elements of Prohibition-era entertainment into safe but exciting fare for an increasingly large urban market, the patrons of which found their way to Miami in the annual tourist season. Miami nightclubs were contested spaces that battled against local authorities to allow behaviors that crossed color lines as entertainers explored the rhythms and motifs of Afro-Caribbean and Cuban music. As Julio Capo Jr. notes in his award-winning book, Welcome to Fairyland, nightclubs and other entertainment venues crossed gender and racial boundaries seemingly with little interference from authorities, at least during tourist season. Miami Beach, historians agree, emerged as an adult playground without the family theme parks and roadside attractions that brought more sedate tourists to Central Florida. Tourists flocking to Miami came for an adventure. They came to be naughty. Chief among the nightclubs of post-World War II Miami Beach, Copa City stood out for its sheer audacity in everything from its sweeping modern construction, featured on the cover image of the Quarterly, to its high-dollar entertainment. Fulfilling its vision of glamour laid the foundation for its downfall.
What do you mean? Did Copa City spend more on its image than it could generate in income?
Yeah, Revel analyzes Copa City and the nightclub era to make three related arguments. First, nightlife existed in a defined geography of glamour that drew tourists to Miami Beach. Secondly, he uses the story of Murray Weiner and his club Copa City to illustrate the competition between nightclubs that pushed owners to take enormous financial risks and produced a gold rush mentality that ended in collapse. Finally, he argues, the movement from the nightclub district to the cloistered spaces of glamorous hotels ended the reign of niteries that ushered in a new era of entertainment. Niteries concentrated in two key areas of South Beach. On the ocean side, visitors found the 5 o'clock Club, the El Chico Club, Wits Inn, Boscia's Villa Venice, and Bill Jordan's Bar of Music. On the bay side stood the largest and most noteworthy venues, the Beachcomber, Copacabana, Kitty Davis's Airport, later Airliner, and Mother Kelly's. Among other venues scattered around the area were the Paddock Club and the Royal Palm Club. Revel notes that in 1940, with a population of slightly more than 28,000, Miami Beach was home to more than a dozen niteries. In the post-war era, nightclub owners shelled out large sums of money to attract nationally known entertainers to perform in their clubs, including Milton Berle, Maurice Chevalier, Sophie Tucker, Lena Horne, Louis Armstrong, Josephine Baker, and Cab Calloway. Milton Berle was offered $20,000 to play the Copacabana. The bidding war for performers was most vigorous between the owner of the Beachcomber and Weiner of the Copacabana, later Copa City.
And Miami Beach's glamorous nightclub era continued well into the 1950s, right?
It did. Murray Weiner arrived in Miami Beach in 1944 from Coney Island, New York, where he learned the nightery trade. In a sleight of hand, using the good credit of his partner, he purchased the Monte Carlo for $96,000, renamed it the Copacabana, and bought out his partner. He gave the Copacabana a $100,000 facelift and joined the talent war. On June 7, 1948, a fire destroyed the Copacabana. Standing in the ashes, Weiner voiced the possibility of attracting the foremost modernist architect, Norman Bel Geddes, the so-called Grand Master of Modernism, to design a new nightclub. Almost like something imagined in Hollywood, Bel Geddes agreed. After 7 months of planning and construction, Copa City opened in December 1948, just in time for the tourist season. With movable interior walls and no interior columns to obstruct patron views, Copa City could accommodate 150 to 800 patrons for dinner, dancing, and performances. The sweeping entrance had no neon lighting. Its plain exterior was elegance personified. Despite its popularity, though, the overwhelming debt incurred in constructing the new club, Del Geddes was never paid for his work, and the cost associated with the escalating talent wars, Copa City closed its doors only months later. Until his untimely death in 1957 at age 40, Weiner continued to pursue his Copa City dream, opening and closing the club several times. After his death, the elegant building hosted a number of less-than-elegant tenants. At the time of the publication of the article, it was a storage facility. Weiner and Copa City were fighting an uphill battle in the early 1950s as Miami Beach engaged in a new form of tourism, the rise of self-contained beach hotels. Offering restaurants, pools, and beach access, shops and nightclub venues, hotels like the Fontainebleau and the Eden Rock promised everything without leaving the hotel grounds. The era of the Miami Beach nightclub had come to an end.
It sounds like a fun era to participate in. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. While Zora Neale Hurston is most closely associated with Eatonville, Florida, she lived and died in Fort Pierce. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Leslie Kemp Poole is an associate professor of environmental studies at Rollins College. I spoke with Leslie about her recent book, Tracing Florida Journeys, Explorers, Travelers, and Landscapes, Then and Now, published by the University Press of Florida. This radio segment is the final in a series of three that highlighted a particular traveler whom Leslie focused on for her book. Mainly recognized for her life and work in Eatonville, Zora Neale Hurston spent her final years in Fort Pierce, Florida, after many successes and failures as a literary writer, anthropologist, and folklorist.
Late in life, she ended up living in a small home that she rented in Fort Pierce, Florida. It was owned by a doctor who knew her brother, at this point, just kind of cobbling together jobs. She was working on a manuscript about Herod the Great, that she was going to write this first a play, and then she was going to write a novel. She didn't have much money, ended up actually living kind of on the charity of this doctor.
In Fort Pierce, Hurston worked at the local segregated high school, teaching English.
One of the jobs she picked up was at the local high school. Now, schools were segregated at the time, and Zora, as African-American, you know, can only teach in the African-American high school. She taught English, apparently not really well. She wasn't really interested in textbooks and following the rules. But some of the students that were in her class would later go to her funeral, and several of them became the highwaymen painters that we are, you know, we laud in Florida, the self-taught folk artists in Florida. So Fort Pierce has a really rich African-American history that she is part of. She had a really bad stroke, and she ended up living in the, of course, the segregated nursing home there, and then died after a second stroke.
Hurston's death in 1960 generated a muted national response, reflecting the obscurity she faced in her final years, despite her once contemporary eminent status. However, the Fort Pierce community at the time acknowledged her passing and celebrated her career. As Leslie stated in her book, quote, more than 100 black residents and a handful of whites gathered for a service, end quote. Leslie added in conversation that the Fort Pierce community today continues to honor her work and preserve her memory.
The local Fort Pierce community has now purchased the building, and they're turning it into an African American history museum that will feature Zora, but will feature other people from the community as well. And every year they have a big Zora Hurston Festival down in Fort Pierce, and the city has actually created a trail that you can follow, and which has markers in different places around Fort Pierce where she, at the school where she taught, at the newspaper where she wrote some articles, at her cemetery site, and again at the nursing home site, of many different places around the city. So she's really being celebrated in Fort Pierce, even though she was only there a few years.
Given that this segment ends my three-part series on Florida travelers based on Leslie's book, I will share the following response from Leslie when I asked her what we can learn about the state from these varied traveler experiences across centuries, from Bartram to Rawlings to Hurston and the others she featured in her book.
Well, I find it fascinating that when people talk about the American colonies, they always leave Florida out. But Florida actually had two colonies, East Florida and West Florida. We were part of that entire colonial world. And so Florida's history stretches back even before that with the Spanish exploration. So, and St. Augustine is the longest continually occupied city in the United States, but we kind of get left out of the narrative of U.S. history. And I think the people, because so many people in Florida today weren't born here, they don't know that narrative. They don't understand the rich history that we have. The varied landscape. We have a landscape that sometimes you have to be taught how to understand. We see lots of water, but we don't really understand that our water supplies comes from underground and how precarious that can be. So there's a lot of subtlety to Florida and a lot of things we just don't talk about or that people haven't been taught about. And so I really hope that following these stories will give people a sense of the history, a sense of the beauty as well, and maybe inspire them to get out and do their own travels. I tell my students we're located in the Orlando area, but you can get 15 minutes out of Orlando and you can be in some really beautiful natural areas. And for me, that restores my soul. And so, of course, I just assume it would do the same for anyone else. So my recommendation always is that people get out of the urban chaos and get into some wild areas where you can kind of take a deep breath, relax, and recreate yourself. At the end of every chapter, I have a little bit of information about how you can go to some of the sites that were noted in the book, and I hope that people will take advantage of that and go do that.
To learn more about Florida's environmental history through key individuals who traveled the state across centuries, consider purchasing Tracing Florida Journeys, Explorers, Travelers, and Landscapes Then and Now, published by the University Press of Florida. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.